Okay, let me just, by way of introduction, I'm Dave Wiesoff. I'm with any one of these number of different organizations, but I started out with International Bird Rescue. But being before that, I spent 35 years with IBM and enjoyed every minute of it. I was in finance industry marketing and then finance industry development. And my area of specialty for basically over 30 years, was check processing systems. So if you ever want to know, back then or even now, how does that check get from your checkbook all the way through the process and then come back to you in the envelope like it used to, or the image comes back to you and whatever. If anybody ever wants to know how those checks get processed, I'd be delighted to bore you to death with it. But one of my jobs, and this was in the in early 2001, was to forecast for IBM the strategy for that industry. You know, how much money should we invest in hardware, software, consulting services, and things like that? And so I went in, did a lot of survey work, and determined out how much equipment, whatever. And I said, basically, let's figure out a way to very gently and smoothly just go out of that business, because we could see when checks were going to go away, and we could see how they would be captured at the source, and we didn't need a lot of heavy IBM equipment and all that kind of stuff. So as soon as I completed putting together that strategy, I said, thank you. It's been a great 35 years, and retired at that point. So, but one of the part of my, kind of to introduce myself here into this context, was one of the things I was responsible to do is to, every time IBM announced a new product or a significant modification to any other product, whether printer, tape drive, CPU, operating system, whatever, one of my jobs was to say, how could the check processing business, which is in all the large commercial banks, which represented 25% of IBM's total revenue, how could I integrate all those other IBM products into this check processing strategy? And so what that caused me to do is to develop, anyway, an interest in all those different technologies, whether it's how you get, how you get inkjet dots on a piece of paper and then run that paper through at high volumes, how do you store more and more data, and there were some number of times when we were ahead of the curve when we could develop equipment, but the channels couldn't move that data back and forth fast enough, or the cost of storage and image of a check was huge, and now it's pittance. But so that was kind of what got me just the interest in lots of different kinds of technologies. And then when I found, after retirement, International Bird Rescue, I started applying that same sort of interest, if you will, on birds. And not only, where they live and why they live and things like that, but also how they've evolved and how they survive and certainly how they behave. And so that's kind of where I'm focused. But I joined Gila Bay after I fairly quickly after International Bird Rescue, because Gila Bay's interest is making the water off of Southern California, the marine environment, safe, healthy, and clean. That's for surfers and bathers, but by the way, it's also for birds. I noticed that in bird rescue, where we were taking care of sick birds, some of the time they came in because of pollution in the environment. So I said, well, maybe I can get ahead of this thing and help reduce the amount of pollution in the environment through working with Gila Bay. And then Five Gyres is an organization that's very much concerned with the amount of plastic in the world's oceans and how we can reduce our, if you will, our plastic footprint, how much plastic we use, Yeah, please don't ask for a straw. You don't need a straw, that sort of thing. But very involved with them. If you're involved with birds, you probably want to be involved with the Audubon Society, and I live in the territory of the San Fernando Valley area, and so joined San Fernando Valley Audubon, and we go on bird walks and do education, and I do classroom education on behalf of that organization. And then if you're interested in life on Earth of any kind, and that's you and me and everything else, then you've got to be interested in the issues related to climate change. And so that's sort of all that. And any point, I may launch off into something like that, but I'll try to come back to the main topic at hand. So having any questions about that? Okay. What's fascinating to me is not only how birds work metabolically, and how they digest their food, and how they oxygenate their blood, and how they reproduce and all that, but also how they behave. And behavior tends to be a physical manifestation, and if behavior is physical, of course, it's neurological, et cetera, but the physical characteristics of it we can measure. And we have been measuring physical characteristics of birds for many years, for hundreds, thousands of years in some cases in terms of raising chickens and things like that. But in terms of wild birds, you go clear back to the first really outstanding bird painter was John Jay Audubon, who some of you may have heard, an amazing artist, painter, and he started painting North American birds in the 1810, 1815, 1820. And he used the technology because, of course, if you're a painter, it takes you a while to sketch a bird and that kind of thing. And since he couldn't find a good battery for his digital camera, in 1820, he used what was at the time known as a fowling piece, and that's a shotgun. And so he would go out and say, oh, that's a nice bird. I think I'll paint it kabooly. Hit it with a shotgun. That was the only choice. And then very carefully mount it such that he could sketch it and he could capture the colors. And he would always draw that picture in context. You know, it'd be on a limb or on a telephone. No, it wouldn't be a telephone wire. It would be in a natural setting. And sometimes, like, there's one with an eagle that has a snake in its mouth and things like that. And so even at that time, people were beginning to think about the behavior of birds, not just the fact that they're flying back and forth and wouldn't you like to be able to fly. And so behavior of birds just shows you how many different kinds of birds, how they reproduce and things like that, all built around behavior. And just to make things more complicated, there are 10,500 species of birds on the planet. And of course, in order to be a species, technically speaking, you don't interbreed with any other species. And so they are 10,500 individual species, organisms that behave differently. If they behave the same and they could reproduce together, then they wouldn't be a species. And sometimes the behavior or the appearance or whatever is very, very small, but it is enough to differentiate them between among other species. And sometimes the only reason they don't reproduce is because they're not behaving correctly. And that's one of the first things when you get a species and it sort of becomes isolated, maybe because of mountain range or whatever. If the bird's behavior, like during the courting process, begins to change, well, pretty soon it's like, you know, you go into a bar and you know, if you come here often, you know, people don't like that, the other bird doesn't like to hear that. And so they don't mate. And if they don't mate, then they continue to evolve separately and they and become different species. So even behavior can drive evolution, or evolution can drive behavior. But one way or another, even behavior can develop a cause speciation, a separation of species. So we're studying this, and there are just so many different ways now with the technology that we have to learn more and more about the behavior of birds. So, for example, I have here, by the way, every bird, when it leaves the nest for the first time, whether it be a little tiny hummingbird or a bird like this, which is called a great egret, or a bird like this, when it leaves the nest for the first time, it's as big as it's ever going to be. So when you look at these birds, you say, well, that's mama bird and that's baby bird. No, that's a great egret and that's a snowy egret. And they're separate species, and you'll find them pretty much in the same place. But they are completely different species. They don't crossbreed, and they've probably got 1,000 years of separation, or maybe 10,000, 50,000 years of separation being separate species. I took this picture at Descanso Gardens up in La Cañada. Right, they have a lake up there. I'm a docent up there as well. But look at this. These two birds are now. What are they doing? They look like they're mimicking one another, but they're standing on one leg. Have you ever asked yourself, why do birds stand on one leg? You've seen flamingos. Have you ever asked? You're all inquisitive people. I know you are. Why? Ever ask yourself that? Well, there's the ornithologist, the pure ornithologist, would say the temperature of the average bird is 105 degrees. They're a very warm-blooded creature. So here I am, a bird that's standing on a cold pipe or on a cold rock or cold water, and I want to reduce by half the amount of heat I'm giving up to the environment. From that part of my body that isn't insulated with feathers, how can I reduce by half the amount of heat I'm giving up? So the ornithologist explained they're standing on one leg to preserve body heat. Is there a physicist? Anybody consider themselves a... Okay, well, please don't... Please don't take umbrage. But no, the physicist would explain, Dave, the reason birds stand on one leg is because if they lifted the other leg, they'd fall down. Don't say. Okay. So in any event, the behavior can be explained by this preservation of body heat. Well, you don't know that unless you take the temperature of the bird, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, some of this technology that we've been using for many, many years is not new, but it's still very helpful. And so this is a king penguin colony. I took this down in South Georgia, which is, off the coast of Antarctica. And these are king penguins. Yes. Well, but if they lift a leg, they have to put their wings out and they have to take some particular action. Maybe it's just face into the wind. I know, you're right. Birds can't. But they told me this is a colony of 180,000 penguins. Now, I started counting and got to about 172,000, and one of them moved. And so I took their word for it. But the problem I have here, and maybe you have really bright eyes and what have you, is what about that guy? Should I have counted him? Is he different? There's 180,000 king penguins and one Gentoo penguin, by the way. I didn't realize that until I got the picture home and put it in a big screen that I captured a Gentoo. Why is he in there? Well, he's an outlier. He's one of the 1% or something like that that wants to stand. He's a Gentoo and he wants to hang out with the kings. I don't know how that works. But in any event, these all behave very much the same. And by the way, they all look great because they've all just been through their molt. And every bird, all 10,000 species, every bird replaces every feather every year. Every bird, every feather, every year. And so these guys, however, they can only do that during a very brief period in their summer. And so now you don't see a bunch of naked penguins. Well, that'd be ugly. But they do. And so they all come out and spend 4 to 6 weeks on the coast here, going hungry. That's all right. They fattened up. They got body fat, etc. But they're all just basically walking around, talking with them, and losing their feathers and replacing them. So that's the behavior. Otherwise, you'd say, well, why aren't they out fishing? What have you? Okay. This is another type of bird, and I'm going to use a little artifact here, and I'm going to ask someone to, if you would put this loop around your finger. Hold on. It always gets tied up. And it's worth waiting for. If you would put this over your finger, that loop, okay? And then we'll find somebody over here that would do that also. And so you're going to hold it up as high as you can so everybody can see it. So if you'd hold it up, okay? Straighten it out and hold it up. Higher? Oh, got it. Okay, higher. Okay. The wingspan of that bird is this big. This wandering albatross is the bird on the planet with the longest wingspan. And it is the most gorgeous bird. It only weighs about 11 or 12 pounds. Now, it's not the largest bird on the planet. That sort of goes to an ostrich or something. But it is the bird with the longest wingspan. And you say, well, okay, why do you point that out? These birds have long wings, but they rarely flap. They are in the southern or the oceans where there's almost always a wind. And so they'll land on the ocean, peck at the surface, and then when they want to fly, they just go, cheep, and with those wings, they take off. And they have evolved to have an extra bone in their elbow that locks that in place. And so there's a bird, their behavior say, well, that's kind of interesting, and they've evolved to have that. Now, once in a while, if there's no wind, what they do, big bird, but they'll kind of stand up and start running. They've got webbed feet, and they'll start running on the surface, and then maybe go, like, and finally get to the point where they can catch some wind under there. But they virtually, they're birds, long wings, and they don't flap them. So you say, well, that's an interesting behavior. Why does that work, and why do they do it that way? They don't need it. And in fact, the best we've been able to determine is that they use less energy flying than they do sitting on the water. And these birds are constantly in the open ocean other than when they're feeding their chicks or incubating their eggs. And the best math we can come up with, these birds live to be 80 years, And they, in the course of that 80 years, they will fly, soar, 200 million miles all around the Arctic. They're Antarctic. They're constantly flying. And again, that's the kind of behavior you say, well, that's amazing, that's crazy, but that's the behavior. Now, I'll show you some slides in a minute ago. How do we know that? And I'll show you how we do know that. We didn't used to know that. Yes? The kind of bird. So, for example, can you imagine a bird like that trying to hover like a hummingbird? You know, oh man, the physics just don't work. And so these bones on this bone here on hummingbirds is very short, and that kind of thing. And so one can look at the bones, but also the feathers, the flight feathers, to see what kind of a flying bird are they? Are they a glider? Are they a flapper? That sort of thing. But these are amazing birds, and again, I'll show you some things about how we can figure out how many miles they fly in their lifetime and how old they are. Here's another picture of, yes? These particular birds don't, but keep that thought. don't forget about that. But that particular species of bird, no. They would just land on the water, doze off. But they don't, you know, we got an 8-hour whatever. They can sleep for 20 minutes, for 45 seconds, and then go on, and that's enough. So they don't have the same kind of issue related to brains and things like that that cause them. And then there's an organ, I don't know what to call it, in the brain, that connects our two hemispheres together, and that's a wide, big channel. I mean, a lot of data moving back and forth. Birds don't have as much data moving back and forth, so they don't rely on left brain, right brain, like we do for certain behaviors. They can do it from either brain. In any event, the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. In any event, twice a year, barred-headed geese migrate over the Himalayas. Now, the Himalayas, what Everest is 28,000 feet or something. Now, they are smart enough to go through valleys and things like that, so they don't always go up. But this is very, and of course, but at that altitude, there's so very little oxygen. In fact, flying requires 10 to 20 times more oxygen than resting. There's only one half to one third of the oxygen present in the air. So the respiratory system of birds is much more efficient than ours, and so that's why we think that they can behave this way. This is the world record holder. They call it a Ruppel's Griffin. And it was not only seen at 37,000 feet, it got caught in the engine of a jet and killed, one of them did. It got sucked in. So they're pretty sure exactly how high that bird was flying. And so at 37,000, you think it's probably what, 80 degrees below zero or something like that, far less oxygen, and they're doing this. They're flapping, flight birds. Sometimes they'll glide, but they need to flap to get elevation, things like that. Again, they're not going to go up and fly 1,000 miles and then drop down, but they do fly that high. And again, that behavior, why? Because over the millions of years, you know, the mountains are raised, and they just keep going. And all right, if I'm going to get over this mountain range, and the mountain range is growing a year, an inch a year, or whatever it is, over 1,000 years or whatever, they've just developed the need to be able to fly that high. There's a long story, and I don't know if we have time for it, but this passenger pigeon. Well, let me do this. The passenger pigeon is a bird that, of course, in the 1850s, 60s, 1870s, there were literally billions of these birds, and they could. Every year, they spread out, but every year they would flock all of them, virtually all of them, to one place. Now the one place moved; it wasn't always the same place. It would be in Pennsylvania, it would be in Illinois, it would be in Tennessee, so all over the Midwest and upper Midwest they would fly. But for some way, they'd all come and gather in the same place, and so they'd doing that for thousands of years. Well, in the 1860s, two things happened. We introduced the railroad, and we introduced the telegraph. Two technologies. And so now, click, 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 all these birds are now in Canton, Ohio. Okay, get on the train and let's go get them. And they did. and they started killing them by the thousands and sending them off to New York and Chicago or whatever as food. So before we even thought about raising chickens or whatever, they were eating passenger pigeons.
You could kill them by just holding them forward.
And you just shoot, and Eric, you just shoot the shotgun up in the tree, and you know 10 of them would fall down. And so it was that's sort of the other side of the technology was that could be decimated to this population. The last one died, I think it was 1929 or something like that, when the very last one died. Here's the most common bird, most abundant bird in the world, and this is in Africa. And their best estimate is 1.5 billion of these birds. And I can't tell you much about them at all. They're a small bird. I presume that they're a seed eater. You can tell that by the look of their bill and generally where they are. But these just fly around in huge, huge flocks. We're going to talk about a little bit about this when we come to starlings in a minute about how they track and understand how these things work. But this is the most abundant bird in the world. But the ones that we see most likely at this time of year is a quite a different species, and they're very common during certain parts of the year. Maybe they migrate to South America. I don't know, but during this time of year, they're very, 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 very common, aren't they? Okay. In any event, enough. Birds migrate, and virtually every species of bird migrate. Now, and sometimes they only move 1,000 feet up the side of a mountain and down, especially in the tropics where if they're native to the tropics, they kind of stay in that area. But there are flyways, we call them, and of course, the number of species, or the western flyway, the central flyway, the Mississippi flyway, and the Atlantic flyway. And we won't talk a whole lot about migration, but I do want to point out that there was a report just came out yesterday or the day before that we now have, and I'll talk a little bit more about this, the ability for scientists, we've been doing this, to count birds and report them to a central location. And they lined a whole bunch of people up over here along this thing, and over the course of a month, coming across the Gulf of Mexico, 2 billion small birds flew over that over the course of a month. 2 billion birds flying north. And so that very intense, but of course those same 2 million, maybe not exactly the same, would be flying south during the fall. So just to give you an idea, but they show on this line, this chart, is that they are they're not straight lines and they're not strict. They're sort of a wave. And I'm going to show you another chart about how we can take advantage of that and predict perhaps the impact of global warming on some of these migratory birds. When you say change, in which way change, you mean? Oh, think of that path as being 500 miles wide. Yeah, and although they're not evenly spread out, and they'll go around mountains and over mountains and all that, but it's more of a moving wave than it is a 405 freeway. Although sometimes you wonder if there aren't 2 billion cars on a 405 freeway, but nevertheless, they are. But like I said, I've got another chart that shows the impact of the fact that these are flyways and these birds are moving back and forth is, it's a good news and a bad news when it comes to things like climate change. But we'll go into that in a minute. So here, by the way, see the Sandhill Crane comes up through the central flyway right here in Nebraska. There's a little town called Kearney, and you can go there in April, March, and early April, and see 40 to 50,000 of these birds. Just look there, and there will be from about 40,000 of these things, all in the Platte River, which is a mile wide and 2 inches deep, and they just land there at night, spend the night, and then wake up, go out, forage around on farmer field and all that, and then come back, and maybe they'll spend 2 weeks there, and other birds will come in, others will leave, and they just keep moving forward. But that's these sandhill cranes. That's, by the way, that's called a colt, is a baby crane, or a nestling crane, and Canada geese and mallard ducks. So, a little background on some interesting birds and just sort of whet your appetite for some of the behaviors and some of the interest areas that we have. Now, I'm going to go down through many of the, well, virtually all of this list of various technologies. We don't need to talk about them now. But historically, we've used binoculars and scouts, and here's the fowling pieces, and we'll talk about leg bands and spit cameras and things like that. Digital photography has been a huge help in studying of birds. Certainly satellite and telemetry have electron microscopy, DNA. We're going to talk about at least to some degree a few words on each one of these technologies and how they can help us understand the behavior and the adaptability of birds. So, we have in terms of first thing is that, you know, as there are 10,500 species, how do we know which one is which? And so, for example, one of the issues that's Audubon and sort of I'm bipolar on this issue because I don't like wind farms because they kill eagles. Eagles, especially when they're any kind of a migratory pattern, eagles, big bird, and they tend to fly straight, and they can be killed by a windmill. But, however, of course, I'm green, and I want to use all the renewable energy we possibly can, and windmills are very effective at that. And so, as I said, and this was just in the last 6 months, somebody says, we can fix that. But just a picture of bald eagle in case you didn't know one. They've developed now a computer system, stands on a pole, and then reports out to a screen. And it, from a mile away, it's scanning the sky in the direction the birds are likely to come from. And when it sees a spot that then looks like it might be big enough to be a bald eagle or a golden eagle coming in that direction, it can put out a clear visual image to an operator who will say, darn, that's a golden eagle, and it can shut down the windmill fast enough so the bird just keeps moving, and then they can fire it back up again. So that pattern recognition, and to do that with high resolution, and while the object is moving, is fascinating to me, and it gives me now confidence that we from a birding point of view, we still need to put those wind farms where they're not right in the middle of the flyway, okay? But we can, and that's, we know where they are, and that's what, but now we can also prevent these incidental kills, which now are now legal. Which question? That bird? No, that's the system. That's the camera. Yeah. Well, it could be, couldn't it? It's only a matter of time when birds find it. Oh, I can. That might more likely be a. It could very easily be a vulture perch. You know, out in the desert, yeah, that maybe a turkey vulture could perch on that. Anyway, that would kind of mess up the image, the camera. In any event, we won't need to go into that. I have no idea. I have not heard that. And interesting bird, and that kind of brings me a little bit into the subject of the senses of birds, and all birds have an incredible vision. It's much better than ours is. They see in the ultraviolet light. Their visual acuity is much better than ours. And we believe, by looking at the structure of their eye, which evolved separately than ours did, thank goodness, because it's much better, that they can see things much more clearly and vividly than we can. Now, hearing and taste and smell, we know that they have all of those things. But we're not as yet able to do a good job of measuring it. I do have an example of hearing coming up here in a minute, but in terms of smell and taste, we know they have taste, we know they can smell. In fact, that albatross has an olfactory sense that it can smell a dead fish 5 miles away. 5 miles downwind. So their sense of smell is highly acute, but that's albatross. You know, your passerine, your little goldfinches and things like that, probably not. They don't need it. But so tracking birds, we started out, and you can do this now. They still do this, and they put up what you call a mist net, and it's harmless to the birds, but they find it's a sort of a soft net that the birds can't see. And then they just grab them and weigh them, measure them carefully, put them in a little sack and whatever, very carefully, and they put a little band on them and put them back into the wild. Now, this is a little bit larger. These are elegant terns. I have to mention to you in passing that these were in care at Bird Rescue, but you'll never see just one of these birds. There's always more than one. And, of course, the reason for that is one good tern deserves another. Okay. When they come into our center, we give them, well, if we get a lot of them, we'll build a turnstile. But when they come in, we give each bird a little piece of sausage so we can observe a turn for the worst. Actually, we feed them nothing but turnips. But before the... And then when we release the birds, finally release the birds out of the wild, these guys will begin, we give each bird a little tab of LSD to make certain we leave no turn unstoned. Okay, I warned. Okay, so in any event, there's a million. We very rarely get a return. But you can see we band when we release all our birds at Bird Rescue. But this is something that is done when they're doing this net. They'll put a band on it. Now, the bigger the bird, the bigger the band. And these have a unique band for a study that took place, so they're a little bit different. Here's a typical steel band that gets put on all our birds. Now, the interesting thing is that no one would notice this but me, is that all pelicans have four toes. And you say, well, what happened? Well, he had a problem with his toe, so our surgeon, our veterinarian, cut off a toe. And so it's the only three-toed pelican around. But in any event, the point of this picture was to show that we put a band on the bird. And then when the bird dies, if it is found, then they have some idea, well, the bird was banded here, and they found it here. And when they can, if they go and put up a nest and they catch a bird and they see, oh, this bird already has a band on it, then they can say, oh, how big was it then? How big is it now? What time of year would we caught it? This is a different time of year. And so, but the thing is that you'll catch a bird, you'll put a band on it, and the odds are like 1 or 2% that you'll ever catch that, anybody will ever catch that bird again. So you got to bind an awful lot of them, but when you do, then you get some very interesting results. And that's similar to the results we in terms of at Bird Rescue. We get very, very few band returns because our birds are all aquatic. And if they die, they die over the ocean and the band sinks with them. So we here, again, we put a blue band on it and just for pelicans, but this one you can at least see from a distance. So every birder knows that if they're looking at pelicans, they see a blue band, they can read that big number and they report it to us and we'll give them, where was that bird seen. So banding is almost an ancient, they've been doing it in the UK for 150 years or something like that, and it's sort of a community project. I mean, there'll be places in the UK where, you know, everybody, you know, 50 or 100 people will be out banding on a Saturday morning all around their neighborhood, and there their band returns and things like that are higher. Because there's so many more birds that are actually banded. And then here's a big white pelican. Again, this is in Bird Rescue Center. And he has a wing tag. And so that can be seen with binoculars, the number on it, and or a photograph taken, etc. So there's some, but it's a big bird. Little tiny birds you can't put a wing tag on like that. But there's some other things you can do. Another way we kind of keep track of birds and try and identify how many is, and this is, I'm not a specialist in this sort of thing, but we go out on a full moon, the night of a full moon, and there'll be people with spotting scopes, with telescopes, and they'll set up and for a certain 5-minute interval, they'll watch as birds migrate across the face of the moon. And you can see if you counted over the course of 5 minutes, you know, I don't know, 100 birds or what have you, then you from, and over a 5-minute period, and you knew exactly where you were looking, and somebody else is doing it over, someone else, is that you could do the mathematics to say, if it's not this angle field of view, it's this field of view, etc., you can come up with a reasonable projection as to how many birds migrated during that period, during that evening. See how that makes sense? Because that you're taking a sample, but that's the only way. Because like I said, with those birds over the Gulf of Mexico, 2 million birds will be flying over a course of a month, and you don't even notice it. They're up there. You just don't know. Photography has gotten to be a huge advancement, and just especially the high-speed technologies that we have now. But night photography, of course, now you know we don't want to have to use a flash to watch bird behavior, because of course it disrupts their vision, etc. So night photography, we have that is now especially for owl behavior and things like that, is very helpful. We can now put on a type of band or radio, on large birds like this Canada goose, and because it's cheap, inexpensive, you can only detect birds for like 2 miles or something like that. So it's not helpful to to see migratory patterns or things like that. But if you want to see where, for example, probably one of the best examples would be the California condor. Oh, there's 250 California condors that have been released back into the wild, and every one of them is tracked every hour of the day to see where is it, and if it stops moving for more than 8 hours, someone goes out and finds it. And you can do that inexpensively because the area that they're in is fairly small, and radio tracking works. But if you wanted to see them, if they were to migrate, well, they don't, but if they were to migrate, then you'd have to do a different kind of telemetry and tracking, which would be rather expensive, as we'll discuss in just a minute. But that's a great tool, one we've been doing for probably 30 years or something like that. But here's some of the kinds of transmitters that we can put on birds, and they can be very small, 50 grams. Now, these are satellite. Now, when we release birds after an oil spill, we know some of these birds are migratory birds. Some of these birds want to stay local. We know we want to track whether their behavior is normal after the oil spill and we've cleaned the oil off that bird, or whether it's different. And so we want to put out 20 or 30 of these trackers on there and then track them no matter where they go. And that's extremely expensive. And so what we try and do is narrow it down, fewest birds possible, and then only track them for a month or a couple of weeks and get a general idea of the early behaviors right after. If their behavior after release and they were an oiled bird versus one that was not oiled, is their behavior in terms of movement around, et cetera, changed a lot as a result of the response to the oil spill. But that gets expensive, and usually the government, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or someone will do that. But some of these others can be done, universities, et cetera. And so this is a bird. We just released one of these. It's called the Laysan albatross. Now, the bird I showed you with the 11-foot wingspan was the wandering albatross. This Laysan, which is on the far reach of the Hawaiian Islands, has a wingspan of 7 feet, only 7 feet. That's about a 7 foot. So they're a very large bird, and so they can and do put tracking devices on these, on albatrosses, and there are 22 species of those. So here's what these birds look like on Midway. Many of you people will know where Midway is. But on Midway Atoll, which is about 2 square miles of land area, 2 million albatross call that home. 2 million birds, and these are the adults, and these are the chicks. And they radiate out from this little 2 mile out to the far reaches of the North Atlantic. And you say, well, where are they going and why are they? Well, that's where we can put trackers on them. Now, this is a map that tracks a lot of different albatrosses. But here is the one we talked about, the Laysan albatross, which is this sort of greenish, yellowish, I guess it is up here. And the other one is this wandering albatross. That's down here. But there's a little blue here, and that's what's called a black-footed albatross. And so these two birds up here, those are black-footed albatross. They're the only two in the picture, but they would be represented in some of these areas. And then there's another bird called a short-tailed albatross that is up there. But there are only 3 species of albatross up in this neck of the woods, and there are about 18 or 19. And down here, this is where they are. But you can see all these birds had trackers on them, satellite trackers, and this is where they spend their time, depending upon primarily where the concentration is around the colony. But they will. The wandering albatrosses are just everywhere. They just continue to circumnavigate around here. And again, we know that by putting trackers. Yeah.
Is that
No, it's the fact that that out of the 22 species of albatross, they look the same. There's three, like I said, that have the long 22 out of the three out of the 22 have a 11-foot wingspan. Virtually all the others have a 7-foot. But those that there's three species of albatross, only three species up here: the black-footed, the laysan, and then this short-tailed. But there is also one that isn't shown here. But there is a bird called the Galapagos wildlife albatross, and they are right on the equator. They don't even show up because there's so few of them, and they probably didn't want to disturb them. But they're only around here, and there would be a very small circle. And then all these others could be on various islands down here. It's just where the albatross are on the planet. And so this is their annual, and they don't migrate as much as they radiate out and come back and radiate out and come back. But since wandering albatrosses only lay an egg every other year, they're really spread out for 1.5 years, and then the other time they're concentrated around where the nesting site is, and so that's why their tracks are all over the Southern Ocean. Here's a particular species of birds. This is a Campbell and a gray-headed. You can see here's the island where they breed. Both of them breed here, and you can see they're moving out. Now this is a fairly limited range, and there's small populations of these two species. But again, we wouldn't know that. There's no, you know, when you look about how big that is, I mean, how many ships would you go with guys with binoculars spending years and years trying to figure out where are these birds or where are they coming from, where they're going? It's just physically impossible. But you put some trackers on a few of them and then let the satellites do the counting and things, and you can just track them and see this is where they are. Now you say, well, Dave, that's interesting. Now we know about their behavior, a little bit more about their behavior, and we've even got it here by species and how far they radiate or whatever. And you say, well, why is that important? Well, albatrosses are, like so many other birds, they're sort of a sentinel species. And that is that if the populations are declining or the ranges are not where they usually are, it means probably that there's some consequence happening as a result of a shortage of food or tremendous weather patterns. There's something that is disturbing their normal flight and their normal patterns. And so we can see, and I'll give another example in a minute, how that can help us make decisions on fisheries management, on how much krill do we take out of the ocean, how many small fish, forage fish do we take out of the ocean in order to preserve the entire food web that is out in the deep oceans where we can't, it's very difficult to measure the individual fish and where they are. You can track the birds and the birds will go where the fish are and help us find them. This is a bird. This is one of the first birds that they put a tracking on. He's about that big. And you see, you just look at him, you see this feet. You can see he's a shorebird. He lives around the shore, but they nest in the very northern part of the ANWR, the Asklan National Wildlife Refuge, right up at the Beaufort Sea. So they're very high in the Arctic where they nest. And like so many birds, the reason they do that is because mom sits on the nest. And there are so many mosquitoes up there that all she has to do is go, tip, 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 tip. She doesn't have to, like a robin, go and look for earthworms. I mean, just boom, 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 boom. And she can feed her family without hardly moving. And so that's why they're up there. You don't want to be up there. But they do. And so they do that. But this bird, one of the first one we had, when we got to this tracker was small enough, satellite tracker, constant tracking. We tracked the bird for 9 days. And it flew from the northernmost part of Alaska to the southern tip of New Zealand. Took it 9 days, is 8,000 miles, without stopping. It's a shorebird. There is no shoreline along that route. And so they couldn't. And this is where we said, how do they do that? You know, we're still trying to figure out how this alternate hemispheric sleep we think is what they do. They sleep with this high, this half of the brain, and then they sleep with half of the brain. And we think that it may be only for 45 seconds or maybe a minute or something like that. But we haven't developed, we've developed the technology, but not small enough to measure brain waves in birds and record it on a device. Now, we're still trying to get it down to where we could do it with a, you know, a typical bird. But I think they're going to come up pretty darn soon to where we'll be able to figure out how do they fly and how do they when they're how do they sleep when they fly. Yeah. Excellent question. This bird, if you weigh it while it's nesting, a couple of weeks before it starts its migration, they start eating for themselves and they will add on 50% additional weight. It gets to the point where these birds, when they leave the nest, when they leave the area, the fledglings are all ready to fly with them. When they leave, they have trouble flying. They're so heavy because they put on, and this is all part of the metabolic process for these migrating birds, is they have fat tissue that can expand and connect and carry all that much additional fat. And it's basically all high energy fat in their bodies. Well, in the picture? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's the only food that's available, is mosquitoes, insects, but basically it's all mosquitoes. But they just bulk up. It's really phenomenal. And some of these little tiny birds just say, you know, that's a tennis ball. You know, it's supposed to fly, and it's a, you know, whatever. But they that's but again, that's all part of the hormones that kick in on the regular cycle, you know, and it's probably all starts with, well, it certainly all starts with the time of the year, and they migrate up, and then, you know, their hormones kick in, and they need to build a nest, and they need eggs, and they need to whatever, and then finally they need to migrate south, and all that's driven by hormones or genetic. I don't know whether, because the satellite doesn't allow us to do that, and I don't know that, but we do know how fly some species fly. I don't know specifically with this one, but it's probably 10,000 feet. They're not going way the heck, if they're flying over the ocean, but they're smart enough to know, you know, that the winds are, you know, blow from different directions at different times of year and at different altitudes. And so these guys, and all these migratory birds have developed their. That's one of the reasons why they migrate the way they do and how they do and all that is that there are wind and currents that assist them. They're not flying into the headwind the whole trip, sometimes, but not the whole trip. But that's all part of the cycle, if you will, that they have evolved to adapt to. But they don't. Now, like I say, we pointed out some of them, you know, fly over the Himalayas, and so then we know how high they go. But typically, they're at 10,000 feet or something like that. there is as close to an infinite number of mosquitoes as you can imagine up there in the tundra at that time of year. And you just don't want to be a caribou. You don't want to be a warm-blooded creature up there. That's brutal. That's... Yes. You lose a pint of blood an hour. But in any event, so this is one of the first ones that really got us 9 days without stopping. How do they do that? And we've got some pretty good ideas. This is an alpine swift there off the coast of Europe. 4 months without stopping. And these are birds, this is the year old, that these are insectivores. They're eating insects. And they fly around like this. And if you've ever seen a swift, I mean, that's, they don't call them swifts for nothing. They go around. And for over 4 months of continuous flight, and they got tagged in with data loggers, and these are the things that they store the data, they don't transmit the data, so they could be more cost effective. But then they then have to find the bird, and it's got a little radio transmitter or something. So it logs the data, and then eventually we can get the device and read the data off it. This is an amazing bird in and of itself, but the fact that it is measured to have 28 days of continuous flight. It's a beautiful bird. From here to here is about, what is that, about 3 feet. They're a pretty good-sized bird. But look at the wings and look at that tail. These birds are extremely aerobatic, and that's because, wait for it, they are kleptoparasitic birds. Okay, klepto means to steal, and parasitic means a parasite. And so these guys, well, they will go down and grab a fish off the surface of the ocean. They'd much prefer to see a tern coming over and just fly into it and smack it and get that tern to drop its fish, sometimes to barf up the fish, and then the frigate bird comes down and grabs it and takes it off to his family. So they'd rather steal a fish than catch a fish. And maybe, I don't know how you feel about that, but that doesn't sound fair to me, but nevertheless. And so there, this is a magnet. There's two species of these. You can see them down in Florida and whatever, but this one I got in the Galapagos. But they're a really pretty bird. But another thing is about this bird is that it never lands on the water. Doesn't sit on the water like a duck or a gull or anything. Never does that. And it never stands on land. It's never sets foot on land. Well, you see, this is they perch on anything they can find, including the mast of a ship or in a bush. You know, where they live in the Galapagos and whatever, there aren't tall trees to perch in, but they'll be in a bush. But they build their nest in that bush, and they hang out in the bush, but they never. So they got all this craziness going on, but they're not called magnificent for nothing, I think. But they're one of the most interesting, fascinating birds on the planet. You folks have seen this. Maybe you've seen you driving down the freeway or out in the middle of the, and these huge swarm of starlings. And they just look they take these amazing shapes, and it's like a cloud. And I wish I should probably put on a video of this formation. But we say, well, how do they do that? You know, a morph into this shape, and then they swing around, they come around this way. One of the reasons they do that, you know, sometimes you'll see them break in half, is a predator may be coming at it, and they'll split apart, or that sort of thing. So that's why, but what they're doing now is, and they've just, in the last few years, and they use stereophotography with trifocal technique. And so they know where some of these birds are going to be. And so they'll set up these high-speed cameras and on gimbals and things like that. And so they can follow the flock, and they can follow the flock and look at an individual bird, hundreds and hundreds of individual birds, and track them real time. And so they can then see, was there one bird that caused it to go in this direction? Or was that the same bird as last time? And they're still trying to figure it out. But at least now they've got all sorts of, this is sort of an interest of how they do it in three dimensions, that they can detect, you know, the movement of these birds. And once we understand how they move, then, and maybe a little bit of the why they move, then that gives us a little bit more insight into their behaviors. But it's flock global dynamics, and it's, again, you can imagine. Well, I mean, we've been in technology long enough to see how that could happen. But now that it's inexpensive, relatively inexpensive to do that, it's just fascinating to me. Any questions? Okay. I'm sorry. Say that again.
This big word that you put after
starling. Murmuration. Murmuration. Google that, and you'll get amazing videos.
The
derivation of the word murmuration, I haven't a clue, but that's what it's called. But just Google, I'm serious. If you guys last meeting, you forgot, just Google murmuration, and you'll get some actually astounding photographs of these things. And again, now that we've got, you know, high-speed photography and things like that, we can do that. And you can sit at home in your bunny slippers and watch. It's fascinating to me. Now, here's another different. This is I've not seen this a lot of this done lately, but recently, and that's using pit tags. Now, there's no battery in here. And it requires an antenna. And then a reader, an integrator, and a computer. It's about this size, you can see. And what they've done here in Southern California is they've implanted them very carefully
just in the back of the neck of about 24 hummingbirds. You know, hummingbirds are really small, and so these things, these pit tags are virtually weightless. I mean, they're just so small. And they're mounting the this thing called the reader interrogator on the sides of some hummingbird feeders. They're doing it at three different locations in about, I think, 10 feeders each, with about 20 times 3, 60 or so hummingbirds. And they can now track an individual hummingbird as it goes throughout the feeders, and they say, well, now, is this hummingbird always next to the same, another hummingbird the same? In other words, they go around in pairs or triplets, or do they random, or does one hummingbird always come to the same feed? And the reason you say, well, why should I care? You know, I mean, I'm not going to open a hummingbird bar or something where I want to know where they're grouped. It's because then we know that if that's the kind of behavior at a feeder, then very likely that same type of behavior takes place out in the real world in a field of flowers or something like that. That there may be an affinity between a handful of birds that they always want to travel together, or they want to be separate, and that sort of thing. So we can find out more. And this is a relatively inexpensive technology. And so we've got three sites, and this is some good friends of mine that are doing this work, and it's really fascinating. Okay. The next area of interesting technology: citizen science, paleontology, aerial photography, and then recording. And there is now, and it's been developing over the last 15 years, something called eBird, for electronic bird. How many of you folks have heard of it? Okay, the hardcore birders, definitely. And that is, anybody and everybody can sign on, never a cost, and you can say, where are birds in my neighborhood? Where are birds on the planet, what kind of birds, what species, when have they been seen? And you can then enter your data, like I did just yesterday. I got a rather unusual bird in my feeder at home. Now, I can just report that one, and that's what I did. Or I can say, I'm going to be there for 2 hours, and these are all I have you. And all that data, over millions and millions of reports all throughout the world every day, we get some really very interesting data about birds and where they are, where their outliers are, where they're seldom seen, but they are sometimes seen, how many. And we've got enough data to where we're really going to begin to do projections. And that's especially when we're looking at the variability of climate change introducing, well, maybe there are some of these species, individuals within this species, that are now, that even today, are occupying an area like it's going to be 10 years from now or 15 years ago. Okay, and so maybe those outliers, genetic outliers, will be the ones that will maintain the species through this period of rapid climate change. The regular guy, the bell-shaped curve, all the ones in the middle are all going to die off, but this is enough to where we've got enough breeding populations to where we can do that. Questions? Okay, so this is just an entry. I do a lot of birding for San Fernando Valley Audubon, and this is and just to give you an idea that we've seen 279 species in this particular area out in the valley, 3,700 checklists, et cetera. I can say just what did I see in what months, what years. I can then go in and say, when was the last time anybody saw a hooded oriole or a warbler of one kind or another, and I can say, where are they, and when was the last time it was seen? And this, some of these indications, the color tells you that a lot of birds have been seen in the last 30 days. Yeah. They should be. Let's put it this way. But there are monitors. There are monitors that would say, listen, you may have thought that you saw an Andean condor in your backyard. Yeah. But you did not. We can pretty certain that you did not see an Andean condor. But sometimes, and I reported a bird out in the valley, something called a summer tanager, in February, beautiful bird. And they said, no, you didn't. And I said, I honestly did. I just take a picture. And 2 weeks later, in the same spot, somebody took a picture. And so I want to say I was vindicated. But because I didn't take a picture, I mean, I knew exactly what it was. I went to the book and what have you. But it's so rare that... So there are monitors, and that works pretty well. Because, again, these birds, to a high degree, are predictable, but there are always those outliers, you know? And maybe that one guy there is going to get a friend, and he's going to develop a whole new kind of, not a subspecies, but a genetic type of arrangement to where that's where they're all going to come when the earth is, or the skies are full of stuff. I know. Exactly. Now, just to give them their due credit, you know, how many of you folks, probably many of you have seen humpback whales. And, you know, there is a database, and this has been going on for 20 or 30 years, where the fluke of a whale is unique. The coloration, the pattern on the fluke of a humpback whale is different enough to where if you can take a picture of it, they want you to send it in, and they can tell which whale that is. And they can say, oh, this is the first time Sally has been seen off the east coast of Maui in 20 years, or that kind of thing. But that's because they're so unique as individuals. But that's the same kind of, that's a little bit different kind of citizen scientist, because you can't key it directly into the system. But this you can. And so, I mean, and there's also something called iNaturalist, where they're doing the same, where you're thinking of thinking about, where you can do the same thing, only there you go out into an area like Griffith Park or whatever, and you count all the species that you can identify and take a picture. And then you can upload that, and someone will say, well, that's not an Andean condor, but it is, you know, a California condor, and so they'll record it, and then they'll keep track. But it's all species that you think you can identify within a certain area, and that's called iNaturalist. So there, it could be a bird, it could be a centipede, it could be a, you know, whatever.
I had to think.
Yeah. Well.
So, yeah.
Yeah, well, and that's now the crows are additional. Now, I have to say just because it's one of the most frequently asked questions is how do you tell the difference between a crow and a raven? And there's a number of different ways. Some of them are kind of subtle, but just put this in your back pocket. If it hops, it's a raven. If it walks, it's a crow. Now they're not always on the ground. You know, they're flying ahead, and the tail of a raven is V-shaped. The tail of a crow, but that's always that. So sometimes, of course, ravens are substantially larger than crows, so that's a big, sometimes you can't see it. But I love this thing. If it hops, it's definitely a raven, because crows never hop. Okay.
Mm-hmm. How the bird can distinguish with North, South, East, West? Oh, they have a magnet or something?
Oh, you're asking the question that hundreds of scientists are even studying at this very moment. And that is, how do birds navigate? How do they know which way is south and which way do I need to go? We're pretty sure we know when is hormonal, that when they start to migrate north or south, it's their hormones that kick in. But how they get from here to there, I'll tell you, is a big mystery still. There have been some interesting studies done. There are microscopic iron ore in the brains of some birds that we think act as a magnet, and that they can fly, they can migrate by magnetic north, not magnetic south. We think that some of them, they can put them in a cage and they can change the rotation of the artificial stars in the sky, and they can see the birds wanting to try to orient that way, etc. So there are lots of different, and I think right now, probably if you ask a whole bunch of ornithologists, they say, we've got three or four ways we think it works, and it's not the same for everybody. But we're not sure which is which, but it is still pretty much of a mystery. But they've got organs. There are some birds where the skull of the bird is actually thin enough to where their brain can directly perceive light. Not through the eyes, but actually through the skull of the brain. And we think that they can orient with the sun in some ways, without, even though they might be blind, I mean, et cetera. But there's still a lot of work that's being done. It's still a mystery. It may just be that there's just a whole lot of different ways, and it's evolved over through many different species, coevolution, and they've all done it differently. Some of them we know. Some of them, like the whooping crane, we know they navigate by sight. If they start out in Canada, they can't get to southern Texas unless somebody shows them the way. But once they show them the way, they can do it. But they don't start out that way. Where others, like some homing pigeons and all that, they just know where to go. So it's a really good question. That's probably the most difficult one that we're working on now. Here again, more on eBird, and you can say how many species we saw, all hot, whatever. So that's a big, that is huge, in especially this is that kind of technology. It's just right at the right place, because we really do need more and more and more data about where birds live in the summer and the winter and where they migrate to and from and that kind of thing, because then we can begin to predict with using climate models. What is the temperature? What is the precipitation going to be north and south? We know it's going to change. And then what birds are going to be disinclined to want to go there or what have you. And so that kind of extensive millions of reports does it. So I had the opportunity to take some feathers to the electron microscope lab in USC and put some feathers under the microscope. And here is a brown pelican. And you see this here? These are called humuli. And I only mention that because that might be on the test. Okay, the humuli. And that's what interlocks the feathers to the degree that this bird is waterproof. Okay, the birds that are not waterproof don't have these little interlocking characteristics on their feathers. And so water droplets can penetrate their feathers. But if they interlock, the droplets just microscopically, the droplets and surface tension prevent it from getting into the inner feathers. But this is fairly new. But this begins to get us into a whole lot of stuff about bird feathers. So just generally speaking, the evolution of origins of birds, you know, we get down to T-Rex here in 150, and we got this little Archaeopteryx 150 million years ago that sort of was a dead end. And we work our way up through this chain about 120 million years ago, and we've got some really good fossils for 120 million, even up to 66 million years ago. Some really good fossils, and here's where we figured out that dinosaurs had feathers. And in fact, let me go on and say here, for example, is ancient bird. And there are areas here that are faint. If you look for it real carefully around these wings, you'll see little patterns of feathers. And the feathers of this bird of 150 million years ago are virtually identical to modern bird feathers. The only exception is that the shaft is thinner, not the thing that makes the tube that makes the shaft, the straw, the plastic of the straw, or something like that, is thinner. And so we don't think that Archaeopteryx feathers, wing flight feathers, could withstand flapping flight, because they are just too fragile, if you will. But gliding flight, they probably could. And so the notion, and this is very, I was still controversial, is maybe what Archaeopteryx did, it kind of climbed up the tree and then glided to where it wanted to go. But we're not sure. But Archaeopteryx died off. And then here is about 166 million years ago when the asteroid hit and wiped out lots and lots of life. That is when right after the last birds that had teeth died out. And we think after the asteroid hit that the only species that survived that impact, and they think there's somewhere around 15 or 20 species of birds that survived that impact, that none of those birds had teeth. Now, about 120 million years, we looked out and we could see that some bird species were evolving to have teeth and some of them were evolving not to have teeth. And there's advantages to both, but it looks like for some reason or another, maybe it's because all the meat of the big herbivores and all that wasn't there anymore, whatever it is, why the birds that did not have teeth were evolutionarily advantaged, but they were. And so that's why birds don't have teeth today. And we can look back and we saw, you know, ducks evolved about, you know, 50 million years ago and et cetera, until finally these songbirds that we see in our trees, we trace about 5 million years pretty much. Now we've got some species in between, but that's when we begin to identify when that clade was announced. So just to give you an idea, but we also know, here's Archaeopteryx again, and here is feathers, patterns of feathers that says this. Now we're now looking through some of the older fossils and the newer fossils, and we're beginning to look for those patterns where in the past we haven't even bothered to look for them. And we're now seeing more and more feathers to the degree we know that dinosaurs had feathers. We're not sure exactly what they look like, but the patterns in the fossil record are pretty good. And you combine that fossil record with the prior slide on electron microscopy, and they can look at the microscopic fossils, feathers, and they can see not only were they feathers, but they were iridescent feathers like a hummingbird has. They can see the little tiny grooves that cause iridescence in the feathers of hummingbirds and some butterflies and some beetles. Little tiny grooves like the back of your CD when you see a rainbow. Those little tiny grooves are now seen on the feathers of some dinosaurs. And we can also, through some of the cellular examination, we can begin to have a pretty good idea what colors they were. Because some of the colors of birds are defined by the shape of some of the cells. And so if they can see the same kind of shaped cells, they can think, well, that's maybe a red feather, a green feather, something like that. Some of this is still very new, but it's getting to be pretty darn exciting. And then another bird, figure that one out. Now this one, golly, this is the one that I'm getting really excited about. Because you see, here's the flyways we talked about, okay? You know, they're flying back and forth. And then we can now take a single feather of a species of bird that's, let's say, in the wintertime, it's here. And then they migrate up. But they don't, if they're here, they don't always, all these purple guys don't all move and end up in the same place. They spread out, okay, up here, let us say. And so we gather a feather up here, we compare it, we can find out where that bird ended up. Just by randomly picking up feathers and genotyping and all that. So we can compare the feathers. We don't have to kill the bird, we just pick a feather off the ground. And we can say, well, maybe all the birds in this section all end up right here. And all the birds here, most of them end up here. And some of them end up here. And so we can say now, these species, if this changes, then maybe this particular group, which is genetically a little bit different, is going to do fine when the climate changes up here because it's sort of moving into his sweet spot. Does that make sense? But these guys here, well, they ain't going to make it, but they're still the same species. They're just a little different genetically. And so maybe climate change, if we're really lucky, is that some of these birds will be the ones that are more successfully breeding because they are more comfortable in the new world of climate change. But on the other hand, the issue is that the birds can adapt like that, but the insects they eat might not. And the seeds that they eat might not. And so it's not just can the birds adapt to different climatic conditions. It's will the food that they need adapt as quickly as they can. And that's a huge threat to birds. The best guess we have now is probably in 50 years that we're going to lose half of the 10,500 species on the planet, somewhere like that. Or at least severely reduce them. So one last thing, recording of bird calls that helps us identify birds in areas when we can't see them. And this is where technology doesn't normally work. This bird called the ivory-billed woodpecker, and you may have heard of it, very rare bird. And somebody said, well, I saw one in an Arkansas swamp. You probably know. I got a picture of this bird in an Arkansas in 1990 or something, whatever the date was. And somebody said, no, you didn't. Yes, I did. No, you didn't. Well, that photograph is sort of blurry. We're not sure that could be a pileated woodpecker. We don't think it is. And when he says, well, you know, a ivory woodpecker, when it pecks a tree, it goes. He's got a unique rapping. And so they put out all sorts of microphones and captured all sorts of hours and hours and hours in this swamp, listening for the... And, wait a minute, we got one, we got one. And then it says, well, wait a minute. There's another bird that goes... And another bird that goes... What happens? Oh, well, we hadn't thought of it. When you know, it's sort of like that. If you put down an infinite number of monkeys in an infinite, they'll type the great works. Well, this is it. Record enough sound and out in the middle of the forest, and you just, odds are you might well find that. So there's still work to be done on that. This beautiful bird, I'm going to skip over that. Wind tunnels, we look at, now we could do this, we do such things as put a hummingbird in there with a knot, and we watch how, and using very, very high speed cameras, we can see how their wings go in a figure eight. They don't necessarily go like this, they go, which allows them to do that. So wind tunnels are great. Critter cams, especially on penguins, we can see them underwater catching fish, catching krill and things like that. They're, of course, they're rather expensive, but, and then, we thought, and the first time I was in Antarctica, we thought the Adelie penguins were beginning to lose their populations. We were really worried. And I was there just a year ago, February, and they were really seriously concerned because when we went out to the same spots looking for Adelie penguins, there were very few of them. And then, within that last year, a satellite flew over a place called Danger Island, which is the right tip of the Antarctic Peninsula. And they looked down and they said, there's this blob. What is that down there? And they zeroed in. And it was a colony of 1.5 million Adelie penguins. They're still on the planet. There are still lots of them. They have all, for some reason or other, moved there or what have you. But what made this also interesting is that, and this is where it's got practical application, is they looked down and roughly every pixel in that screen is about a square meter. And they could see the color of that square meter. And if the color is generally pink, it means these birds have been eating krill, which is sort of a shrimp-like critter that's pink. If it's white, it means they've been eating fish. And so then they can count all those pixels and come back and say, well, this year, it looks like they're eating 60% krill and 40% fish. And then next year, if it changes, let's say, well, wonder why. And they can begin to start asking the why of that question. And it may be overfishing for fish. It may be overfishing for krill. It might be the water temperature is not as good for krill as it used to be or whatever. But at least we now know that there is a significant difference. This is down in Antarctica. Well, you can't put enough boats out to really determine how many fish are there or how much krill is there. And so this is sort of interesting, using the penguins as an indicator of the health of the oceans around the Antarctic. You know, I don't know, don't get me going. I had to laugh at this. That's a Adelie. You can see all the other Adelies in the background, and this guy found they flew over the colony with drones to count the birds. So, and then lastly, we use, in bird rescue, we can now capture images of X-rays and determine, you know, what's wrong with them. By the way, here's a bird. Here's that bird that's now only got three toes because this one is amputated. Sea level rise. Have you guys ever heard of GRACE, the system? It's two satellites, and they send down I believe it's a laser. But these satellites are precisely synchronized to be, and I'll make it up, exactly 100 meters apart. And they track that and they maintain that, so it's exactly, or they know if it's off, they know how much distance is here. So they're perfectly aligned. And so as these two satellites fly over a landmass or whatever, and they're shooting down, they can sense by the movement of the satellite that this landmass is a little bit heavier than the one behind. Okay, and because it's pulling it down. And then it flies on, and the other one pulls. You see how that works? Because they're flying in perfect synchronization and matching them all up. And so now these things are flying over the Earth all the time, and they're monitoring the level of the ocean, and they're seeing how land masses are changing. because they have this precision down to, I don't know, a centimeter, millimeter, whatever it is, to be able to do that through this. They also flew this around the moon to determine the gravity face of the moon. So, I can't think of anything else, but I would be delighted to answer any questions in the 2 minutes that I'm
ready.
Yes?
Is it true they all taste like chicken?
All I can do is tell you what people have told me. And the cute little puffins, for example, they're amazing birds. I don't have a picture of one here in this deck, but people tell me that it tastes awfully fishy. They just, you know, it's not very good. I've eaten Canada goose, you know, legally caught and hunted, whatever, when I was in college, and I wasn't very excited about so they don't all taste like the chicken. There's some of these fish-eating birds that you just, you know.
Is it krill a small fish?
No, it's a tiny, it's about a half an inch long, and it looks very much like a shrimp, only a very small. And they're a distant cousin of the shrimp, but they're incredibly important in the food web, all over the oceans. Baleen whales, all the humpback whales and the fin whales and those guys all eat tons and tons of krill. And so now they're beginning to be harvested. Yeah, but the big problem is they're huge factory fish coming out of Asia that are taking it in by the hundreds of thousands of tons of krill. Any other? I know I've run out of time, and I'm sorry.